things that they don't know about, either from the point of view of Torah, or from the point of view of science, or from the point of view of normal intelligence. So, therefore, I decided that I should discuss these things with the entire human body to make sure that you understand that Tamir Chacham is not a bunch of primitive stupid people, and the Torah is Baruch Hashem Chai V'Kayim. It's Emes L'Amita. Now, what has recently happened is a certain young man from Manchester, England, who, when he came to see me a year ago, 2 years ago, whenever it was, it wasn't a major event in my life, so I don't kind of recall exactly what happened. I was not aware that my mechut in Manchester had thrown him out of yeshiva for inappropriate behavior before he subsequently went to a different English-speaking yeshiva in this country. He came to me with a manuscript of a book. Campbell, Hyrax, the hair of Campbell, the Hyrax, whatever the name of the book be. My friend of David Gottlieb of Osamea had read the book and suggested that he speak to me about the book. He emailed me a copy of the book, I read the book, and I then came over to my house and spent a good amount of time. Basically, I told him that come out every point in the book is wrong. And number one, he was also to publish the book number two. And I went through, but it wasn't, I went through step by step by step by step. Of course, it would only confuse people who Hashem. It would make people feel that there was a problem with the Torah, when it's really very simple. And in general, his attitude was the voluntary world. There was a lot of chutzpah and a lot of arrogance. Of course, then, when the book was published, it was published, I'm not the world much yet, so I don't have to. I thought most intelligent people would just let it go by. Then, subsequently, over the past 6 months, a tremendous storm has arisen over his other books. Then, on Motzei Shabbos, I saw that not only in interest in intellectual honesty, in the introduction to this book, right, I showed this book to a number of people, my name was included, and not everybody agreed with everything. To Elul, there was a point here that I didn't agree with, a point here I didn't agree with. Now, it's not that I didn't agree, that not everyone agreed with everything. I agree with nothing in the book. Number one. Number two, the use of my name by him is just another example of absolute intellectual dishonesty that this individual has. And, now, let's get to the Inyanim, with a background. Take a look in Mishnah Perkei Avos, Hapachba, the Hapachba, the Kulaba. Turn Torah over and turn Torah over because everything is in it. Take a look at Rabbeinu Yonah there. Rabbeinu Yonah says, all problems of the world are in the Torah. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Borei Olam, created everything. All problems of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are in the Torah. That includes the problem of everything. Now certain things are nigra, certain things are nigra. Torah, you understand in four levels. Pshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod. So, it is Gemara in Becheiros, and I've quoted it to many people. Together with also Medrash in Ambrosius. Is that in the Chumash? Chumash, 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 Chumash. Okay. On the Pasuk, in the Kalala to the Nachash, so the Baruch Hu tells the Nachash, Orato, in kol ha-behemim, kol chayat ha-soda, ha-zechon chetelech, v'osatol chal kol yomei chayim. The Rashi in the Pasuk, or Atan Kol, the Hayim Kol Hayat Hakada, says, called the Gemara in Becheiris, Medrash, that, well, in normal English, but nowadays I assume most people don't know English, the gestation period, that's the amount of time from the beginning of pregnancy to birth, of a Benachash is 7 years. Wow. This is a Gemara. The Gemara says that Chazal were specific people in Rome. The leaders of Yeshua was walking down the street and he met the Roman philosopher. At that point in history, philosophy and science were one. And this philosopher scientist had what was different people want their life's contribution to this world to be different. This man had spent his life studying what is the gestation period of a nachash. Experiment, putting a male together with a female and separating them because it's hard to say. You never notice when a person becomes pregnant. So, and after an entire lifetime doing this, all of the experiments before, what is the gestation period of a nachash? 7 years. He's walking down the street in Rome, bumps into Yeshua, and says, maybe you know what the gestation period of an nachash is. I don't. You don't know. And so he, obviously this man thought he was this big intellectual, you know. And Rabbi Yeshua was Gedolei HaTanoim, didn't know, Rabbi Yeshua Hanan. So Nafu Pana for Rabbi Yeshua. A little bit later, Rabbi Yeshua meets Rabbi Gamliel, walking a little further down the street. And Rabbi Gamliel says, Lama Nafu Panacha, why do you look so depressed? That's because the Salat's asking this question, I didn't have an answer. And said, what was the question? He told him, and he said, no problem, 7 years. He says, how do you know? And he shows him how he darshened out of the pasuk. And so Rabbi Yeshua went running down the street, grabbed the philosopher, says, it's 7 years. He says, how do you know? That's the pasuk. And showed him how he darshened out of the pasuk. Says, and this philosopher began banging his head against the wall and said, listen, I spent my whole life doing it, and this guy in 2 seconds learned it out of a pasuk. My first act of Gemara, the one thing that bothered me about the Gemara was, why is it so upset with himself? Why wouldn't the muscle pump? If someone would come up to me and ask me that question, I'd say, listen, no, everyone has different areas. My area, I'm trying to understand this, I'm trying to understand Ksubis. How long it takes a nachash to go from pregnancy to delivery, it's not my area. Except we understand Torah in our very limited way. The Gedolei HaTanoim, who had a total view of the Torah, if there was something about the Briyah that they didn't understand, they knew that it was chosen to them in the Havanat HaTorah. So Rabbi Yeshua, not knowing the answer to this, understood that not knowing the answer that meant is part of my idea of HaTorah that I'm missing. HaFok, BaVaFok, cool, everything's HaTorah. And therefore, and then he meets Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Gamliel says, Hanachanan, it's in the Torah. Take a look at the Ramban at the beginning of Reishis, Nahagdama. Ramban says, what was the godless of Shlomo HaMelech? Shlomo HaMelech, Havanat HaTorah was so great that he was able from the Torah to understand everything in the world. The entire Bria he was able to understand through the Torah. The Ramban says. And that was here, Shlomo HaMelech, and of animals, of birds, through the Torah. And if you take a look, the Medrash, in Parshas Noach, on the story of making the Keter and then the dimensions of the Keter. So, Medrash says, if a person wants to know what relationship between height, width, and length of any vessel that'll make it the most seaworthy, take a look at what it says in Parshas Noach. It says in Parshas Noach that you make the teva, say le choteva, say go. Well, there's a shlosh meos amr. 300 amrits is the length. Chamishim amarachba. So the length is six times the width. Ushloshim amar kamasa. And the height is one-tenth of the length. So if you want to make something that's most seaworthy, make it with those percentages. The height, one-tenth of the length. And the width, one-sixth of the length. It's a measure. Now, yes. The Medrash is reacting to this pasuk. The Medrash understood there's something interesting about this pasuk. Why did the pasuk have to tell us exactly how long and how wide and how tall the table? Doesn't make a table. The Medrash says, Kach, live the Torah derech. Here the Torah told you something about the world. There are a lot of things about the world. How to make a light bulb. It's also something about the world. How to make the most seaworthy boat. So Chazal understood that so the people would understand in a clear way that the Torah has everything. In one instance, turn to an extra post, it really wasn't necessary to show you. You want to understand how much the Torah understood about the world. Will tell you a fact about the world. I mean, cannot have gone. Here it's the Nigra. Every other place is the Remish, the Drash, the Sod. If one will make an experiment, this was an experiment that was made in the Naval Architecture Laboratory in MIT, that what are the dimensions that will make a boat mostly worthy? And guess what? They found out the boat was like. Some people have to do experiments, others just read the pasuk and read a medrash. Now, Chazal's understanding of the metzias of the world is combined with a number of different things. Much of it, not most of it, comes from a havana of the metzias of the world from Torah. I'll give you two examples. Every one of you, I'm sure, at one point learned that the relationship between the circumference of a circle, the diameter of a circle, is something called pi. Now, there's some people with understanding of Torah is primitive. They point to Pesukim and Halachim and think that Torah assumed that pi was 3. Okay, and they make a whole thing about it. No, Torah is much too sophisticated for that. As a matter of fact, the earliest recorded place in mathematical history that pi is an irrational number. Does anyone know what an irrational number is? It cannot be expressed as a fraction. Pi happens to be also a transcendental number, not only an irrational number, but another level of sophistication you won't get into. But the earliest recorded mark in mathematical history that pi is an irrational number, the Rambam Perish Mishnayis, as it uses it from a mission. It was not, this fact was not known to the mathematical world for the 18th century. Number one. Number two. Now, I can just give you examples that any person who, in any elementary level, it doesn't prove anything except when people want to find it that Chazal had a very primitive view of the world. Heavy Yodea, that Chazal had a very more sophisticated view of the world than most people have even today. Number one. Number two. How long is the solar year? So, most people say 365 days. People know there's a prominent leap year. Say 365 and a quarter days. That mistake was made by all Roman and Greek astronomers. That's why when the calendar was set up by Julius Caesar, called the Julian calendar, it was set up 365 days, and once every 4 years there is a leap year. Now, all of us know that's the way it goes. The Julian calendar, it was set up that the vernal equinox, and the autumnal equinox, is September 21st and March 20th. Okay, this is the way it was set up. as time went on, people realized that things were sort of floating away. And in the Middle Ages, by that time, certain amounts of science had become more sophisticated. And Pope Gregory of the Catholic Church changed the calendar for 11 days. And that's why we now have the Gregorian calendar in the secular. The Gregorian calendar is based on the fact it's on a 1,000-year cycle, that every 4 years is a leap year, with the exception of the year ending in 00. 1900 was not a leap year. 1800 wasn't a leap year. But once every 1,000 years, like the year 2000, it was a leap year. So you in your lifetime will probably never experience a year that's a multiple of four that's not a leap year. You have to 1800, 1900, and 2100. That is how the calendar was designed. In fact, those of you who were here noticed that there are two different celebrations of the supposed birthday of Otto-ish. One in the Western world, December 25th, and one in January of the Russian Orthodox Church and the Greek Orthodox Church. The reason for that is that while Pope Gregory changed things around, for everyone who's in the Catholic and Protestant world, the other world wasn't changed around. Now, when we were Makadei Shaltiriya, we didn't have to have a calendar. But in the 4th century, since Kiddush HaChodesh Shaltiriya has to take place in Eretz Yisrael, and the Golos was spreading and the Sanhedrin was being mispatel, so Hillel HaAkra made the fixed calendar. The machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban of what the marker of our fixed calendar is. The Rambam writes Talocha Moshe Sinai. The Ramban writes Sefer Kana Dei LeMakadesh LeChodesh Al Shem Osir for all Chodoshim Ad Bias HaGoel, and when we're going to go back to the old system. And the Rambam writes no, Halacha Moshe Sinai is there is a calendar which is part of Halacha Moshe Sinai. And when you're not Makadosh HaPiriya, then you just go back to the calendar. And all Hillel HaAkra did was Mevatel Kiddush HaPiriya and saying, now we're going to the other option, which is Halacha Moshe Nisan. Now, this calendar we have is based, we have actually two calendars, if people haven't noticed. We have one calendar which is based on Tkufa Shmuel, and another calendar which is based on Tkufa Zavada Barav. Tkufa Shmuel is 365 and a quarter days. And when do we use this? We use this for two purposes. One, for the purpose of Saint Talmud. Saint Talmud is Takonos Chachamim. It is 60 days after Tkufas Tishrei. So someone, when is Tkufas Tishrei? Tkufas Tishrei is the day of the equinox. And it comes around September 23rd. So 60 days later should be November 23rd. But our patron uses Shmuel calendar. That's why it's on a 4-year cycle. It's either December 4th or December 5th. So I remember when I was young, someone came, discovered Chazal didn't understand anything because 60 days after Tishrei, we now have December 4th, December 5th. If you take a look at something called Birkas HaChama, I don't know whether many of you around the lot Birkas HaChama, something you have every 28 years, it's a bracha, and my sagacious, that's based on Shmuel's Tkufa that the year is 365 and a quarter days. That's the problem, right? Anyone who thought it's a problem simply met. Sometimes an intelligent person goes from step one to step two. A more intelligent person continues step three. A brilliant person will take four steps. This person basically went step one to step two, wasn't intelligent enough to take step three. Our calendar is based on the Tkufa of Rav Ada Bar Ava. We have a 19-year calendar. Now, the Cheshbon of Rav Ada Bar Ava, on which Rav Ada Bar Ava based our, the Tkufa of Rav Ada Bar Ava, on which our calendar is based, take a look at the Rambam, gives exact detail how long the year is. Based on this, it has exceeding precision. Our calendar can be very precise, basically until another 2,000 years, when it gets a little bit off. And the precision of that measurement was not known to science till after the first satellite went up. I remember, when I was growing up, before there was such a thing as satellite, people said, the year is this, the year is that, how it stands with Rav Ada Bar Ava, our calendar. The fact is, after satellites grew up, that's when the most precise measurements were made. And then, now, the current length of the year and our length of the year don't exactly overlap. Because we want to put explanations for that. Chazal, the calendar had to have an ability to have a functional cycle. We have a 19-year cycle. To use the precision that we now know, it would have a 2,000-year cycle, which wouldn't be manageable. We needed a manageable cycle. So Chazal used an approximation which gave them a 19-year cycle, which was, for all practical purpose, an approximation that we didn't need a better approximation than that. But that approximation was way ahead of any science until knowledge that we had in the 1960s, early 70s. Number one. Number two, the exact length of the year and the exact length of the day, one should not assume is an absolute constant in the world. Anyone who read any of the scientific discussions that happened after the recent earthquake that caused the tsunami knows that the length of the day now changed after the tsunami from before the tsunami. Maybe by a thousandth of a second, but when I thought I said, you see, very natural catastrophes can have a hashpah on the length of the day and the length of the year, so it could be at the time of Chazal, it was absolutely precise. Okay, no, it really doesn't make a difference. What well, does make a difference? Chazal, in the calendar that was set up approximately 1700 years ago, there was a precision. It was greater than any precision known to science until the second half of the 20th century. So when people want to feel that when Chazal, independent of Chazal, when they function, were not functioning with a specific, sophisticated view of the scientific world, these the fact of the knowledge that pi was an irrational number, or that there is a, or the precision of the year, both of which are very fundamental facts that enter into halacha on an ongoing basis, Chazal had a very clear picture. Why is it that when they came to the same Kalamata, they used Shmuel? Very simple. They needed a functional calendar. 19 years of a functional calendar, they need a certain precision. They made a tekmana, it was Talamorphic. That had to be something that was common knowledge that every person with a city could be able to figure out. And for the purposes of Chazal to do it every 4 year, on a 4 year, according to Shmuel, fit the needs of that was the tekmana, if not they were in. Fit Chazal's needs. The Birka Sachama, to have it on a, Chazal wanted in a human being's lifetime, to be able to recite Birkas Hachama once every 28 years, so a human being's lifetime, say 2-3 times. If they would have used Rav Ada Bar Ava's calculation, it would have resulted in saying Birkas Hachama once every 196 years. It would have meant Birkas Hachama would have been irrelevant at all. That's why in two instances of Chazal used one approximation. And when it was in a different time, Chazal used a different approximation. In full knowledge of the fact that whatever the Romans were running around with their advanced science and technology was way too primitive for our needs. and therefore we don't have problems with Galilee. Now, on the other hand, there is a famous Maimon Chazal, which is quoted in by letters of Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, that Chazal can sometimes make mistakes in the proof. It's based on a Gemara, the Gemara says there's a certain astronomical machlokas between Chasmei Ha'olam, Chasmei Umos Ha'olam, and Chasmei Yisrael, about the movement of the planet. V'chazu Chasmei Yisrael Lomar K'chasmei Olam. And Chazal admitted they made a mistake. So, Rambam says, quoted by Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, you see Chazal were interested in the proof. And someone showed them they made a mistake. Without going to all the details of that in terms of astronomy, today it's not so clear that Chazal made a mistake there. It's quite not so clear. Now, the answer is very important. Chazal were able to darshan things from within the Torah. Then you understood a tremendous amount about all of these stories. Shlomo HaMelech understood the entire book, but not everyone had the Chochmah Shlomo. Many things that we had as Halacha L'Moshe from Sinai were lost from Meshech HaDoros, and we're able to, by our Havanah HaTorah, get back. Most of Chazal's versions of the Metzias are based on the Havanah HaTorah, which gave them much more advanced ability to deal with the Metzius of the world than any science was able to deal at all. Does not mean that every statement about science within Chazal necessarily came from that. But a few examples to show you that Chazal's Havana of science, A, came from within the Torah and was way ahead of many things that we may think, number one, and number two, that people at that time were certainly aware of. Now, that's a, and therefore whenever one applies this letter of Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, it's not a Chiddush of Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam. The people, like this gentleman who wrote the Sefer, how did he know the letter of Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam? Because it's Hakdamat Rabbi Yanko. As a matter of fact, anyone who's done more learning, if you take a look at the Tshuvas Hagonim, he quoted in the Otsa Hagonim at the beginning of the seventh paragraph, already in times of the Gaonim, when they were aware of that they didn't feel a problem that not 100% of everything in the Chazal, well, in terms of scientific knowledge, was necessarily Torah. The overwhelming amount, yes, occasionally not. Now, when you enter into areas of halacha, some people, for instance, cited Chazal's Havanah of Treshes is very represented a very primitive view of the of medicine. As a matter of fact, take a look in the Rambam and Hilchos Shchita. Rambam is very clear in Hilchos Shchita. Rambam says, yes, after he lists all the treifas, so this is all halacha Moshe. Included in this list, it's only included in this list, it's not, are all makos from which an animal will definitely die. Therefore, if you'll say that in this that in this list of things an animal can live. So, okay. I didn't say that an animal definitely died from everything. This list, Rambam says, contains within it, let's say there are 70 traces, so 15 might be, our animal definitely died. But there's no such thing as something from which an animal definitely died that's not included within this list. Therefore, the Rambam says, I will say that there is a certain marker under current medical knowledge that which we say the animal definitely died. Yeah, that's because we're living in our current medical knowledge. But you can't say that there's not some possible the fool is born someday. That means within our limited knowledge now, there is X, the animal definitely died, and it's not within the list of traces. It's actually, until now we've only seen it die from this marker. But maybe there's better technology, maybe it's a small percentage. That cannot be scientifically proved. But, he says, this list contains within it everything from which an animal definitely died. And there are other things, and additionally, other things. The Rambam takes care of this important statement very carefully, so there's no problem with traces. Rambam was aware, Rambam was a doctor, and the Rambam's definition of traces, you take a look in the Ramban, the third paragraph of Cholin, the Ramban also says it with a slightly different twist. Now, an example of traces. And had the Torah been based on a false Havana of this world, we would have many, many more problems than we have. But if people begin to point to problems, have a problem here and a problem there, an occasional problem. And people never duck problems. We don't have the approach the Catholic Church has. If you go to the American consulate down the street and see right in front of the American consulate, there's the beginning of an excavation that got stopped in the middle. What happened? I think it was in the 30s. While the British were in charge, they began doing certain archaeological excavations right there, and they found something that looked like the wall of Yerushalayim at the beginning, during Bayis Shemesh. Right there. Now, if that had been the wall of Bayis Shemesh, then there would be serious problems. Why? For the Catholic Church. Because if you go down the street from there to Shar Shechem, which you should have done, because that kind of Nefash is now, but those of us who walked around Yerushalayim before it was a second of Nefash, on the left-hand side is something called Gana Kever. That is supposedly, according to their belief, the place where Osirish was buried. Now, since no one was buried inside Yerushalayim during Bayis Shemesh, if this excavation were correct, then it would turn out that no one could have been buried there. The Catholic Church got bent out of shape entirely by this. So what did they do? They didn't say, well, let's make the excavation to see whether it's true or not. They put pressure on the British government to stop the excavation. It's a dodge and buckle. Right, let's not get confused with the facts, and we'll continue doing what we're doing, and we'll hide from the facts, even though you take a few doubles, and just dig, so no. That's why, in 67, when Israel conquered that, and some archaeologists wanted to begin excavating that, a simple letter was sent to the British government, don't start with that. We're not Catholics. We know the world. We understand the world. We're Christians 100% of the world. That's what you have to understand. Now, what I want to do is, because this gentleman had somehow created problems that do not exist and created issues that do not exist. So, and people are walking around now very confused. I want over the next few weeks to go step by step, explain to everyone that one doesn't even have to be a sophisticated scientist to understand that there is no problem. Give you one simple example. You do have to, and it, a lot depends on an initial attitude. No. In my youth, when I studied philosophy, so I was once in a philosophy class, the way it was set up, there was a big lecture twice a week, 700 people in the lecture, and then we broke up into discussion groups, someone else in the faculty. And I don't know the Jewish religious background of the person who was leading my specific group, but I learned a very important yisod. After a few weeks of various discussions, the person, and I was an active participant in them, young at the time, 18 at the time, and it came out, you know, so this person somehow saw me sitting there with a yarmulke being somewhat intelligent, decided it was her responsibility to prove to me there could not be such a thing as a bond coming this way. Okay, so while we had until then begun working on the course's curriculum, curriculum was dropped for a while, and there was one curriculum. Convinced the class that it could not be a bond coming this way. So we would walk into the discussion group. First half an hour, this hour discussion was a whole system of proofs, etc. And going through the class, and you know, if you have anything to say, and everyone would shake their head, oh yeah, very impressive, it couldn't be. And then after half an hour, this member of the faculty would turn to me, and now Mr. Meisner, what do you have to say? And I would sit back and say, you know, you can look at it from a different angle. And by the end of the hour, we ended up taking. It was 1 week, after second week, after third week, after fourth week. After that, I was looking around the class. A lot of highly intelligent people in the class. I'm not saying I was more intelligent than anyone else in the class. So I was wondering, why can she convince them? And to them, it's all logically perfect. And when it gets to me, somehow I show it's not so logically perfect. The answer was the following. She had her agenda. It was an agenda. And everyone in the class, either they shared her agenda or they had no agenda. So they could be very easily convinced by all these logic arguments. I had my agenda. So there is a bonus on the So I can undo all of her arguments and she couldn't answer me back. So that meant her arguments weren't arguments. She began with such an agenda. But then it went through. This course took the next step. The course took the next step in which, at the end of the course, you have to write a term paper. So I decided I was going to write a term paper and prove to the existence of God. I initially was going to do on something else. And I told, remember the faculty, that the faculty told me, if you can do that, I'll become an Orthodox Jew. It's the only religion that makes any sense. It's such a, with such a challenge, obviously I had to write a good paper. Okay, Kahava, I presented five of the famous arguments, I defended three very well, and I finished the term paper with the following statement, that I really don't understand the necessity. Because if you accept Maimon Har Sinai, the proof of the Rambam writes, so what do you need all these proofs? And if you don't accept Maimon Har Sinai, so what's the point of the proof? What are you going to do about it? There's a bonus on it. So what are you going to do with it? But when I got the term paper back, so I did Baruch Hashem very well in the term paper, and she couldn't shake the argument. Then I came, now I came as I was a Balchov. I came to collect my debt, you understand? When I was younger, I was a bit of a wise guy, so so I came to collect my debt. I said, no, I mean, so what's with Shabbos? What's with Kashrut? and she looked at me and said, I can't accept it. I said, it's okay, so just be kind of a hobby, you'll say it's an irrational belief that you believe there is no functional. Accept it as an irrational belief and just say that's the way it is. So, and that is, you have to be very careful with a lot of arguments. And, see, at that point, if you were specifically sophisticated, you believed that the world went back in time infinitely. Then in the mid-60s, all of a sudden the Big Bang came out. So, the world had a beginning. The world had a beginning, so people got a little nervous that meant there couldn't possibly be a Bria, and if it was a Bria, that would be a Bore. And people got a little bent out of shape with a lot of things that they were feeling about at that time. So then, all of a sudden, someone came up with a theory called the oscillating universe. What is the Big Bang? The Big Bang says we can notice that the universe is expanding today. So if the universe is bigger today than it was yesterday, the day before yesterday was smaller. You just, if you go back infinitely in time, you have to come back to a certain first moment. So then they decided, now how do you, so that's going to force people into Bria. Bria is a Bore, it's a Torah, right? They get problems. So they came out of the eye, even though we notice it now, it's really oscillating, going like this. That was the theory of the oscillating universe. I remember, I lived in California, I was asked to speak in UCLA. And at that point, the Big Bang was pretty new, and we're talking about all sorts of things. I talked about the Big Bang. The Hillel rabbi there in California was a Shana Bapirish. Stands up and asks me a question. What about the oscillating universe? So I look at myself. I'm glad you asked that question. So Rashi and Chumash. Where's Rashi and Chumash? Yeah, simple Rashi. If you take a look, what happened to the Dorah Plogger? So, Dorah Plogger, Chazal, but how did Dorah Plogger happen? There were people around who still remembered the Mabul. So you couldn't say there's no Rabbon Shalom in the world. They remembered the Mabul. So they came up, so what, take a look, Rashi says, that once every, they said once every 1,300, I don't know how many years, something happened. Anyone, there was no one around 1,300 something years old. So where did they come up with it? Because there's a simple, but you're sorry, that when the facts try to push you to say there's a burial, and you come up with a theory that cannot be disproved. So that means, they used to have a theory the world was infinitely old. Okay, we disproved that. So then they had to put that into the Bore. So they had to come up with a new thing to say that not that anyone ever see the universe oscillate in the other direction of it. They had to come up with that theory because otherwise you're going to have to set this back to the Bore. Then along came Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking, if anyone would have read his book, Brief History of Time, happened to be one of the Mishchosim of the past few hundred years. Okay, but he happens to be a brilliant physicist. And he showed you cannot have an oscillating universe. It's a very, after you finish with his equation, it's all finished, there's no such thing. The universe just goes like that. Okay, but that again is a very uncomfortable way of confronting the world, because then there had to be a first moment. There's a first moment, there's a Bore. What do you do with it? But as every brilliant mind who refuses to confront the fact there's a Bore, Stephen Hawking came up with another idea. The fact is that we have an understanding of time, that time is only a positive number, it's not a negative number. So what's negative? What does it mean? He says, no. That's not how the world goes. So basically, to put it into sort of layman's terms, without going into all the mathematics that's involved in Hawking's thing, the world is an oscillating universe, but not physically, but in time. So the world is like a movie. Now we're playing forward. At some time in history, it's going to be like a movie going backward. So last night for supper, I put something in my mouth. When this movie goes reverse in 10 million years, it'll happen, I'll be taking something out of my mouth. But the movie's going back and forth, because time goes back and forth, it's not the physical universe goes back and forth. Did anyone ever see this happen? Obviously not. LMI, it goes back to the whole thing of the oscillating universe, okay? It goes back to the door outlook. That when you confront something, it forces you to accept. The fact is the Boreolum, the Supreme, you got to come up with a theory. And the more you can make the theory impossible to disprove, the better the theory is. And this is called science. Okay. And, who is like the number one physicist in the world today? Stephen Hawking. But so you have to understand sometimes the scientific theory that, you know, people worship science and scientists, but you have to sometimes keep things within a perspective. That any normally reasonable, rational person today will admit based on all physical and physical evidence that the world had a first moment and something happened. Now, if there's a first moment, so the question is, and all of a sudden there's a big bang and everything exploded out, something had to have triggered that first moment, of course. And that is a major problem in science, how to deal with it. Okay, so some of the deeper minds say, listen, when the world exploded, not only the physical universe came into being, but time came into being. So before that, there was no such thing as time, so you can't ask any questions like that. So, now this is science. That says when things get too uncomfortable, then you come up with a theory. So when I first saw that, I said, very interesting. Now, there is a... Chazal say, why is the first letter a bays? Because you can't liken to a bays, you can't go up, you can't go down, you can't go back. But that we'll discuss in a little more detail this week. But with just one final fact, which is one of the most amazing facts of the story of Briyat HaOlam, of science, etc., which we'll get to in all these so-called scientific books. Anyone who knows, I imagine, high school science, I don't know where you guys went to high school, what level it was, the most fundamental thing in the world is the speed of light. There's one thing, the most fundamental fact, that is unalterable amongst all other natural laws, still is the speed of light. That light goes 186,000 something something miles per second. That's the fundamental fact of the universe. All post-Einstein physics. What is the first thing that a Kaddish Baruch created in the world? The Eon. All right, we'll continue that.